Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. It's a beautiful night here in the desert, a little toasty in some parts of the Mojave, starting to feel hints of the big bake that's just around the corner. We appreciate you choosing to spend some time with us for the next few hours, and yes, I'm confident this is going to be worthwhile, a stimulating bit of conversation. Like many of you, I look at what's unfolded over the last several months on the campaign trail, and I'm pretty much amazed. That's the word, I guess, that won't offend anyone. It is easily the most interesting presidential campaign of my lifetime, and maybe yours. We've seen things on both sides of the partisan divide that we've never seen before and may never see again, and this thing still has a long way to go. A few months ago, I had a thought and wondered, what would Mark Twain write about what's unfolding right now? Some people might think of Twain as merely a humorist, which he certainly was, but as we've seen, especially over the last few years, humorists, comedians, often end up giving us the most insightful commentary about our political travails. You know, millions of Americans get their news from comedians. Jon Stewart became a go-to guy for news for young people, kind of following in the great tradition of Mark Twain and Will Rogers, Mort Saul, Lenny Bruce. And that line of thinking made me wonder what this guy might have said about the current political environment. Remember this voice?
But it's also interesting to notice who it is we assassinate. You ever notice who it is? Stop to think of who it is we kill. It's always people who've told us to live together in harmony and try to love one another. Jesus, Gandhi, Lincoln, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, John Lennon. They all said, try to live together peacefully. Bam!
That, of course, is the voice of the great, iconic George Carlin, who died in 2008, but who lives on. In this digital age, his videos, his bits, his commentaries, alive and vibrant as ever today, as relevant as ever, biting, honest, brutal, certainly angry. And angry seems to be the emotion of the moment for millions of Americans. George Carlin, obviously not available for interviews anymore, but his only child, his daughter Kelly Carlin, has become sort of the keeper of the family legacy. She was on hand earlier this month when the National Comedy Center in New York honored her father, and she's written a memoir. It is her story, but it reveals so much about what it was like to grow up with George Carlin, the forces that shaped his sharp-edged, caustic view of the world, and how he influenced generations of comics and writers and fans. This is certainly no fawning biography that kind of whittles down the rough edges or paints over the blemishes. I read a Carlin Home Companion today and was pretty much blown away. I saw on Twitter someone asking or chiding her for coming on the show, asking Kelly if she planned to talk about Sasquatch or UFOs or Sasquatch in UFOs. Yuckity yuck, never heard that one before. Must have been a tweet from Henny Youngman. Maybe we'll just ask her about UFOs. There's a reason for that. We'll get into it. Kelly Carlin joins me in just a moment, and I really look forward to hearing what she has to say. Then, an hour from now, we steer this radio vessel into strange waters. The topic is not UFOs, but USOs. Unidentified objects seen in, under, or over the water, as reported by the Russian Navy, as well as KGB. Painstakingly collected by veteran investigators Paul Stonehill and Philip Mantle, the book is published and edited by historian Richard Dolan, who will join me in the second hour to talk about UFOs in the political arena, this election cycle, and other related current events. Then Paul Stonehill will be here to tell us about case files squeezed out of Russia's military by various means. Good stuff. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have put together our usual collection of oddities and items gleaned from media sources around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Among the items posted there tonight, how much junk is floating around in space? a lot, it turns out, causing some pretty serious concerns for the people tasked with tracking it all, and of course for the astronauts who hope to avoid colliding with it. Along the same lines, a thought piece from the Washington Post about what's starting to look like a looming space war. Not talking about war against aliens, but other very earthly entities who have their own reasons for wanting to control the high ground of space. Also, as you might recall, one of the last times I was here, we had an interview with Tom DeLonge, the rock and roll guy from Blink-182 and Angels and Airwaves, discussing a collection of advisors that he's put together, telling him some pretty amazing stuff. We did a TV version of that. I went down and interviewed him in Southern California and put it on the air here. We've got links to those two stories if you want to check them out. You want to check out the NAPS news material on the website. While you're there, maybe take a look, click the link that tells you how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a great deal. Costs pennies a day, gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen to them anytime you want, as many times as you want. And with that, let's assume the position. You know the drill, bring in the dog, fluff up a pillow for the cat, put on a pot, pour yourself a cup, slip into those silky jammies and slippers, plop down to the Barca lounger, turn down the light, turn up the radio, because we are ready to rumble in a moment. Growing Up with George Carlin, a Carlin home companion. Kelly Carlin, I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. People of my vintage or older might have their earliest memories of George Carlin when he did his still famous hippy-dippy weatherman bit on TV, did it a bunch of times, or maybe even remember him in an earlier incarnation. He had a comedy partner, wore a suit and tie, clean-shaven guy, clean material, too. If he had remained in that groove, chances are few of us would remember him at all, but he clearly morphed into something else. Unleashed from the perceived need to be mainstream, he became a brutally honest observer of us. Commentator, critic, cynic, a brilliant mind, and a sometimes angry voice who became something much more than a comedian, though he certainly was funny. Wasn't always funny to live with him, though. Just ask his daughter and only child, Kelly, who has written a penetrating, from-the-heart memoir. Her story, for sure, but through the entire tale, the presence of her father and her mother loom large. Kelly is a writer, speaker, and hosts her own show on Sirius XM. Her new book, A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George, is as frank and direct as anything you might expect from her famous father. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited. When I heard the theme music at the top of the hour, I was like, oh my God, I'm on the show.
It gets you, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does. I love that music has haunted my mind for about two decades listening to your show.
Well, I'll tell you, well, I read the book today. What a story. I mean, this is the acorn not falling far from the tree. I mean, I've read online comments from you that maybe your father would not have liked parts of this book, how honest you are and some details that are revealed, though I think you'd have to agree part of him would be proud of you and understand and appreciate that approach of being completely honest.
Well, yes, I hope so. In the end, he taught me how to be a truth teller, even though for him, you know, he never talked about his personal life on stage, certainly. He did a little bit in interviews. I mean, he certainly, I mean, the things I reveal in the book, which is mostly the drug years during the 70s, which are the more difficult years of our family, he talked about openly in interviews. He didn't focus on it. He didn't talk on and on about it. But he talked about it in public. So there's nothing, you know, revealed that is a big mystery or a big surprise. But, yeah, I would hope that he would be proud that, you know, I had the cojones to stand up for my truth. And as you know, you've read the book, it's based on a foundation of love and great pride and great respect for my parents. It's not a daddy dearest. It's not any kind of a book like that. It's just a raw, real telling of our life together.
Well, I mean, it comes through that there was a lot of love in your family and even through the travails, and they were pretty significant. I mean, drugs and booze, and it caused a lot of problems between your mom and your dad and for you.
Yeah, it did. But, you know, I mean, you look at the grand scheme of things, I'm still a rather privileged human who was born into a pretty great family with the means to take care of ourselves. And yes, absolutely, as a kid and only child, being in the middle of your parents' addictions and insanity and chaos and the rage that was created around all of that between them was harrowing and traumatizing for me at the time. And yet, you know, I part of the reason I wanted to write the book was because I was a child of a certain time too. And I think other kids who were born in the early mid 60s who had parents who were, you know, participating in the counterculture relate to my story, you know, because this was like the first generation where parents were, you know, kind of acting out like teenagers as adults. And there wasn't a lot of rules and there wasn't a lot of parenting going on. And so we're of a certain kind of breed, us kids at that age.
I'm with you. the story you tell, it's, you know, the early days struggling to make ends meet, not having enough money for food, or he's traveling all the time. It must be what it was like for so many comedians, including, you know, legions of people who never made it. But it's like two careers you describe, those early struggles, and then he makes it to some degree. And he has a medical episode where he goes into the hospital, and the guy who comes out is a different guy. Tell that part of the story.
Yeah, this is about 1970, and I'm about 6 or 7 years old, and my dad goes in for a double hernia operation, and he's already decided to make the change. You know, like, he's already got sideburns and a little bit of long hair going, like if you watch kind of the progression of his look during those years. But when he comes out of the hospital, I guess he was in for 3 or 4 days, back in the day when they actually left you in the hospital for a few days for something like this, he came home and hadn't shaved. And he was starting a beard and a, you know, a beard mustache thing. And, you know, when you're a little kid of 6 or 7 and your parent comes home and your dad suddenly has facial hair, it's a very confusing thing for you because you're like, wait a minute, where's the guy who left here a few days ago? And so it was a little, I remember feeling like, okay, it's dad. I hear his voice and I know it's him, but I'm not quite sure what's going on here.
So he starts smoking weed at home, and he's not really trying to hide it all that often. Other things come along later, but I mean, he was kind of honest in his own way, and not at least not hiding it from you and your mom.
Oh, yeah. No, he had been smoking weed since he was 14, so that was going on the whole time during the 60s. I mean, on the outside, he looked like the clean-cut guy, but on the inside, he was a radical. You know, he really was. He was just playing the game for his career. But no, he never hid anything, you know, and maybe that was part of the problem as it got more and more intense and the drugs got stranger and stranger. I mean, I'm guessing they must have sheltered me from something, but I can't imagine what it is from what I lived through.
I'm going to jump out of chronological order. I remember this sort of late in his life. I don't remember the exact year, and I don't think you mentioned it in the book, but he had a bout with pain pills, and it's just characteristic George Carlin style. It was a tiny little item in a newspaper that suddenly blew up, but he said, look, I had some pain medication, and then I would take a pill with a glass of wine, and then it became two pills, and he checked himself into rehab, sort of like to stop it before it got out of control.
Yeah, I do talk a little bit about it in the book. It's only a few years before he died, actually. I think it was about 2005 or 2006, and he called to tell me, I'm checking myself into rehab, and I thought it was so funny. I mean, my dad was like 68 years old at this point, and he had been through everything, and he'd quit cocaine decades earlier, you know, and he smoked a little weed every once in a while. And I really didn't know about the painkillers and the wine. It really did surprise me that he had been kind of binge drinking on the road and been taking a few too many of Vicodin or whatever. But and he went and checked himself into rehab for a full month and started going to AA meetings and you know, got sober at the end of his life, which was amazing because my mom in 1975 had gone through that and had to, otherwise she was going to die basically, and had been sober in AA for decades.
I know you were really young when he made that radical transformation. Piecing it together now from this vantage point, was he really struggling? Was he unhappy with the guy he was wearing the suit and tie and doing the material that he was doing, the hippy-dippy weatherman over and over?
Yes. And it's not like I didn't have any conversations with him about this, but just from what I gathered from his own interviews and his own posthumous memoir that we published, Last Words, he really was struggling, very much so internally. I mean, having a major identity crisis, feeling extremely trapped in his work. You know, he was trying to move forward and evolve along, and what would happen is because he got such success with a couple of these bits, you mentioned them, Hippy Dippy Weatherman, kind of the DJ guy, the Wonderful Wino guy, and then the Indian Sergeant. These are like three of his big bits he did. And he would go on these shows like, you know, 69, you know, late in the 60s, and he'd say, hey, I've got some new material, I've got a new thing. And the producer would go like, oh, no, we just want you to do that Indian Sergeant bit again. And so he would do it, but he would like, you know, change the context a little bit or whatever. But he was just recycling the same thing over and over again. And for a man like who he was, who was very prolific, his mind never shut down. He was always coming up with new material, new observations, and the world was changing. I mean, you know, this is 68, 69. I mean, you know, there's like you played the assassination bit at the beginning. You know, people are dying. The nation is divided. There's practically a civil war, you know, and he's entertaining the parents of the people that he really, you know, felt akin to. And it was very frustrating for him. And he felt like he was dying inside.
You have a line in the book that I thought was great. You wrote that Middle America had fallen in love with George Carlin just in time for him to have fallen out of love with them.
Yeah. I mean, and what a position to be put into. You know, he's at the height of his career. He's been, you know, hired to like open for the Supremes in Vegas for more money than he's ever made in a week in his life, like $12,000 or something. And he's miserable. And he starts acting out and he starts getting fired. And finally makes the decision with my mom that, you know, he has to do something different.
You tell a story in the book about a performance at I think it was a state fair where he's blasting out the seven words and the reaction was not good.
Yes, that was Summerfest in Milwaukee. And that was in the summer of 72. And I was 9 years old. Mom and I were hanging out backstage, and so dad's on stage doing Class Clown. The album Class Clown had not come out yet, but he's trying to do this Class Clown material in front of 10,000 very drunk people, and it's an outdoor festival, and his words can be heard throughout the fairgrounds type of thing. So it's echoing, and he's using all the language that he's used to using now. It's 72, and he's doing the seven dirty words, basically. And the promoter finds my mom and I in the wings and says to my mom, the cops are here and they want to arrest him the minute he comes off the stage. And my mother knew that my dad had cocaine and pot in his pockets. So she was frantic. So she grabbed a glass of water, went out on stage, whispered to him what was going on. Here's the thing about my dad. Did he wrap things up and decide to just say, hey, I got to go right now? No, this is when he launched into the actual seven dirty words routine.
Oh, boy.
And slowly the people started, they turned down the microphone on him, so he had to leave stage. And we ended up rushing into the dressing room, and mom's hiding all the drugs and everything. And he walked out of that dressing room, and they arrested him. And it was a terrifying, horrible day.
You have several cases, incidents like that, where he has brushes with the law, where things really could have taken a bad turn had it been slightly different in the details.
Yeah, I feel like in the end that, you know, we as a family got through it, through that part pretty easily. You know, he didn't have a very large FBI file. He was never put on the big, like, Nixon, you know, enemies list, because he wasn't a frontline activist. You know, he may have been acting out on stage and doing rebellious things with language, but he was not at political rallies. He was not making political statements, you know, in more public ways. And so they left him alone on some level, I believe.
We're talking with Kelly Carlin about her new book, A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George. Some fascinating stories still to come. Coming up in a moment, we're going to hear a song that by Debussy that means a heck of a lot. It's not only one of the most beautiful pieces of music ever written, but it has a special significance to the Carlin clan. And, well, we'll listen to it now. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast right after this. Marvin Gaye, what's going on? You know, the world obviously has changed so much since that song was out, since George Carlin prowled college campus stages and ranted and raved about the issues of the day. I mean, the seven words you can't say on television, some of them you can say on television now. And the election season underway now, it could be written by comedians. There's so much weird stuff going on. And you'd love to hear what George Carlin might have to say about how things have changed, what's going on now. Kelly Carlin knew him better than anyone. And when we come back, we'll talk more about her new book, A Carlin Home Companion, about growing up with her famous father, and maybe get his take on what's going on now. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Kelly Carlin talking about her new book. Kelly, there's probably no way you would know this, but I knew your dad. I got to meet him 6 or 7 times. I interviewed him 3 or 4 times for stories on the news here in Las Vegas. And we developed a correspondence over the years. The first conversation I had with him was in the 80s. He was in Las Vegas starting an engagement, and we were kind of promoting it. And then he and I got in a conversation afterward about the JFK assassination, a program I had done. And then I started doing these UFO stories, and I sent him copies, VHS copies of stories we would do. And then he would watch them, and he would send me back stacks of these VHS tapes of his programs, HBO specials and such. I sent him a couple of books. I would see him when he'd come into town and occasionally interview him, occasionally just go to the show. But I'm sure that was never mentioned, but I was just honored to know him because he was so sharp.
Well, I know he was intrigued, very intrigued by the whole Area 51 thing, and was always, you know, looking for some real information about that kind of stuff. I think he really wanted some sort of an encounter or connection with that kind of stuff. And so yeah, it's that's great. I'm so pleased that you guys had a connection. And he, yeah, that was typical of my dad. He'd make a connection with someone, and you know, he'd keep in correspondence with them and send them little gifts and stuff like that. He was, you know, he may have been this blustering guy on the stage, but he was a really genuine down-to-earth guy, and always very generous and kind with most people he met.
I have photos of him, one that was taken in the 80s, another one in the 90s. I mean, the one in the 80s, I still had brown hair, so it goes back a ways. But I was his guy on Area 51 and UFOs, or at least I was one of his guys. And
that's fantastic.
I saw him maybe a year before he died, and the show, it was a little different. I mean, he was always a little bit angry, but he was really angry. And I wondered if you detected any kind of a change toward the end of his life in the material and his approach to his material.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people talk about this, and he certainly, you know, was confronted with it with people. And, you know, and I think the way he talked about it was that, you know, for him, it was more outrage than anger. And that, you know, he talked about how he had divorced himself from the species. And, you know, as a comedic perspective, it was a great perspective to have, because he could float outside of the, you know, of our planet and kind of look at us in that witnessing kind of way. But, you know, I'd asked him, I said, well, if you've really given up on the species, Dad, then why do you go out? You know, why do you bother writing new material and getting up there? And you know, he was honest with me. He said, he's like, okay, well, you busted me on that level, you know, and really thought about it, you know. And he came up with this phrase about being a disappointed idealist, you know, a broken-hearted idealist. And I think, you know, in 72, he was the last time he voted was for McGovern, and we know what happened in that election. And I think he really saw that, you know, there really was no turning this ship around. And he, you know, he claimed he never wanted to wake people up or change people's minds, but that's exactly what he ended up doing, you know, for his 40-year career, which, you know, I always find so ironic for him. You know, he wanted to make people laugh, but boy, did he come out. You know, I always think of him as like the Zen master with the stick that wakes you up during your meditation. That was him. You know, he came around and gave us a good whack every 2 years or so with one of his shows. And some of that was startling for me to see the anger and the level of kind of, you know, disappointment. And, you know, those are emotions from my dad that I always avoided in my life. You know, I did everything I could to make my dad happy. But, you know, it fed his art and, you know, and for him it worked, you know, and I think, I mean, if you look at hear the words behind it, it was always full of truth also.
You look at, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say what a pivotal role he played in sort of comedy being more than comedy. You look at it now, I mentioned in the introduction about how millions of people get their news from Jon Stewart or did, and how the comic minds of today, the commentary is so important to young people understanding the world around them.
They're the only people who are speaking the truth. They're the only people that have the courage to speak the truth. We're not getting the truth, you know, through most of our media. You mean, I mean, that's like the role that your show plays, you know, that, I mean, Coast to Coast have played for decades. It's, you know, it's always trying to give voice to people, you know, who have a perspective that you won't hear in any other media. And, you know, the way corporations run everything in media now, you're not getting the truth. And so, you know, comics are the only ones who really don't care. You know, they don't care. They don't have, you know, they don't have a stake in the game, you know, the political game. So it is the one place that you're going to actually hear what's going on. And it's an essential role for the culture, I believe.
I'd love to hear his take on so much stuff. You know, I miss his voice. You know, a lot of your book is about the price of celebrity. And obviously your dad was a public person who liked a certain amount of privacy. You look at today, I mean, everyone wants to be a Kardashian. Everyone wants 15 minutes and more.
I know. I mean, not only was I bummed when my father died, obviously, but he hadn't seen the likes of Sarah Palin. He died before Sarah Palin entered the race in 2008. And, you know, besides all the normal grief of losing a father and everything, I was also sitting in my life going, and what are we supposed to do with this, Dad? Like, where are you now? And, you know, and who knows? Because, I mean, that's the amazing thing about him. He would come up with a perspective that would be so fresh and so different than anything else anyone else was doing. And the only thing that I've held on to these last almost 8 years now is he had this great line where he talked about, when you're born, you get a ticket to the freak show, and when you're born in America, you get a front row seat. And that line has become more and more true every single year since he's died.
So much material in this election season, and I mean on both sides, much material that he could have had fun with.
Oh yeah. And I think he would also be telling us that we're getting exactly what we deserve. You know, you have to remember that these people come from American schools and American families and, you know, the American culture, and this is what we deserve. So, you know, he wouldn't cut us any slack as a nation.
What would his take be on television now? You know, we hear it's the golden age of television, and it's interesting that it coincides with a heck of a lot of swearing and nudity and sex on television that wasn't allowed before, that suddenly is allowed. I mean, it's not seven words anymore. I don't know what it's down to, but it's not seven.
Well, he was a big fan of British mysteries, so I know he'd love television right now, because you on Netflix you can get access to all the great British mysteries.
You know, your life, I mean, that life, growing up that way, there must have been a point with your parents battling and their substance issues that you said to yourself as a kid, that's never going to be me. And then it does become you to some extent.
Yeah. I think it's a pretty normal story. You know, I mean, if you got the genetics and you've got the environment, you know, although, you know, a part of you thinks it never will be me and you never want to, you know, go down that road. But, you know, I was in high school in the 70s and I had parents that, you know, I called them laissez-faire parents. There wasn't a lot of rules. There wasn't a lot of, you know, putting their foot down and making sure that, you know, I wasn't doing things. My dad shared weed with me in high school. My parents thought if I was at home getting high, at least I was safe at home. You know, and there wasn't a lot of intrusion. You know, my dad, he very much never wanted to, you know, impart those kind of things and tell me what to do or not to do. He was such a rebel at heart, ultimately, you know. And my mom, I think she was just afraid of, you know, her mom kind of was very strict, and she never wanted to do that with me because she thought maybe I would rebel the way she did. But yeah, you know, I ended up getting into drugs in high school, and then in my 20s, ended up getting very involved in cocaine with my first marriage, my first husband. And, you know, and but the thing about it for me, though, was because I'd had so much experience watching my parents, there were certain lines I would never cross, and there seemed to be a limit inside of me. You know, I didn't have to hit some sort of really bad rock bottom with drugs and alcohol like so many people do. I mean, I ended up hitting rock bottom because of my panic attack syndrome, and really my life became debilitated around that. Which forced me to actually get off of drugs because the drugs were feeding it. So in some ways I was lucky in that sense. You know, and wished I hadn't gone down that road, but I did, you know, and so many of us did coming out of those late 70s.
That piece of music that we played a little clip from, what does it mean to the Carlin family?
Claire de Lune. Yeah. So, right after about a year after my mom died, my dad and I went up to Yosemite Valley to spread my mom's ashes. And the last day we were there, we got in the car to go down to the valley floor. And the minute we got in the car, Claire de Lune began to play on the radio. And my dad and I looked at each other because Claire de Lune was, my mother was an incredible pianist. She'd gotten a full scholarship out of high school to study piano, ended up not going for other reasons. But she used to play Claire de Lune in our home for hours and hours, and just, she was an incredible pianist. And she would play it during these like really dark times for her, you know, dark nights of the soul and stuff like that. So when that song came on the radio, Dad and I just, you know, we had one of those moments. We loved these great moments of synchronicity that you get in your life. And it was one of those. It was like, oh, Mom's here. Mom's with us. And, you know, just cherish the moment so deeply between my father and mother and I in that moment.
You know, your dad lives on so much. He's so big these days, even all the videos and clips and bits online and social media. I don't know if there's a way to gauge that, but do you have a sense of how many followers he has, whether how closely people look at his material and miss him?
Yeah, you know, I don't have an exact way of following it, but you know, we run the George Carlin Memorial page on Facebook, and that has over 60,000 people following it or liking it or whatever they do, and my dad has like 20,000 or 30,000 Twitter followers, the official account, which is the George Carlin. So yeah, I mean, they miss him a lot, you know, they really, really do. And that's the message I get from people for the most part, you know, is I really miss your dad. I really miss your dad. And then I hear, what would he say about the election and stuff like that. But, you know, and yes, there's memes, and you go on YouTube, and there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, watching his videos. And the thing that's been most amazing to me, because all of this happened after he died. I mean, 2008, Facebook was just starting, and social media was just becoming a thing. And what's been amazing is my dad's material never really left the United States. He didn't go to the UK and do a lot of shows. He did nothing in Europe. So unless you were a comedy nerd, you really didn't know about him internationally. But because of social media, I now get messages from people in India and China and Russia and Iran and Iraq and Australia and, I mean, just all over, Pakistan, Syria, who are following my father now and learning about his material and, you know, and calling him a prophet because of all the things he predicted and he's talked about for decades before it actually happened.
Toward the end of the book, there's this great section where you talk about the ashes and what you do with your father's ashes and these comedic giants who are part of your orbit. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah. Before my dad died, I didn't know any real, I mean, I knew a couple of comedians. They were kind of just friends, but I wasn't part of the comedy world at all. And immediately the phone began to ring and big A-list comics began calling me. One of them was Gary Shandling, who ended up becoming a dear friend of mine and whose death is just a First Street. So the first night we were in New York, my husband and I, Bob, we go to meet Richard Belzer, who was one of the people who had called me and said, please, you know, when you're in New York, you know, please come and you're family now. I love you and I want to take care of you. And just such warmth from all these comics. So my husband, Bob, and I go to see Belzer at a club, and I've got a little bit of ashes in my purse thinking that maybe I'll go down to Greenwich Village and I'll be able to put some in front of the Bitter End. And I walk backstage and there's Gilbert Gottfried. And I don't know Gilbert, but all I know is I'm terrified of him. He's one of those guys that just terrifies me. And I start telling him, well, what are you doing here? I'm here to spread my dad's ashes. And immediately he says to me, do you have any on you? And the first thing I say is, no. I completely lie to him because I'm terrified. I'm like, I don't know what Gilbert Gottfried's going to do with my father's ashes. Is he going to eat them or snort them or what, you know? But I ended up the next day spreading those ashes in Greenwich Village and all over the city and all these, like, really memorable places where places that meant something to my dad's life and his career. It's been a strange trip of a ride since he died. I mean, these comics have been lovely, and the comedy world has taken me in, and his fans have taken me in, and for the most part, I get a lot of love, and people have come and found my work, whether it's through my podcasting or my book or my speaking, and it's been a lot of light and love, and I really feel honored and privileged to have this life.
And are you the defender of the family legacy? I mean, certainly, you know, the new book, I encourage people to check it out. You've got your show on Sirius where you interview other comics and other voices. And do you get into it with people who might say something about your dad that you don't like?
You know, I did at the beginning. I did. I would get into it. And every once in a while, there'll be a meme that's completely reworded. Someone reworded, some very conservative place reworded a thing, and I sicked the fans on them and stuff. And I used to patrol that a lot, but it's exhausting in the end. And in the end, you can't control the internet. You know, I do a little bit here and there. At some point, it is what it is. His legacy is what it is. His work stands on its own. It stands up. It will for decades. I believe he is the Mark Twain of our century. And I know his legacy will live on. I know in 100 years, if we're still here, he'll still be someone they're talking about, and his views will still be, I think, listened to. So I don't have to protect much of it, but I'm proud of him, and I do fight for him. And you know, being an only child, I want his legacy to live on because I think his voice was one of the most important voices of the 20th century.
There's a section where you talk about the creative process, how he'd write down ideas all over the place. You've got bits and pieces and scraps of paper all over the house. I was thinking to myself at the time, gosh, I hope Kelly saved some of that stuff.
Oh, no, Dad saved all of it, or not all of it, but Dad saved a lot of it. I have about 8 to 10 steamer trunks of his archives, everything, memorabilia, ephemera, handwritten notes, lists, set lists, clippings, clothing, photographs. And this week I announced that I am donating them to the National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York, which is the hometown of Lucille Ball. So they will be a lot of it will be on permanent display, and a lot of it will be archived and available and accessible to academics and scholars in the decades to come. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Kelly Carlin, the book is A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George. It's a great read. Kelly, it's been wonderful to have you here, and I'll send you a note. I'll send you some of these photos I have. We're going to put them on Twitter, I think, of me with your dad. Thanks very much. We're playing a Lionel Richie song. Lionel Richie, not our normal fare here, but Lionel Richie just started a residency here in Las Vegas. And it turns out there's a cabal of fellow Coast listeners on his team, including his video director, Jeff Clare, who's listening tonight, will be back with Rich Dolan, USOs in Russia, in just a moment.